The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Class, Introduction to Mindfulness Meditation. And people are still coming in, so we could take this time for a few minutes if anyone has any questions or would like to report something about their meditation practice at home, if you're doing that. Anything that come up for you or clarification you'd like on the instruction? Yes, please. So meditating on an empty or full stomach. So I'll use that question as an opportunity to say that one of the principles for finding your way in this kind of meditation practice is trial and error. So rather than have something tell you this is how it should be, different people, things work differently for different people. So you have to try it both ways and find out for yourself. Having said that, generally, it works better to meditate when we're not hungry. When we're not hungry, hunger doesn't help meditation, but being full doesn't help either. So there's a sweet spot in between. So if what you call an empty stomach is short of being hungry, it tends to help. Sometimes when the stomach is full, people get sleepy real easily. Sometimes it can be distracting. Sometimes they feel it interferes with their breathing. But try it out and find out for yourself. How many of you tried meditating at home in between, the week between? No? A few of you? Good. Maybe half of you? Good. As I said, I think before, I think that the course builds on the instructions from week to week. And why don't you come all the way in? Or maybe you guys can sit come closer on the floor, so there's space in the back. Thank you. So the course builds from week to week on the instructions before, and also on your experience you have. As you have more experience of what actually goes on in your meditation, then I think the instructions will make more sense. So I think it's kind of designed that way. But I've also kind of designed this course so that for people who don't meditate, I'm hoping that some of the principles and ideas that are being taught here you'll find applicable in your life in general as well, so that hopefully something is useful outside of meditation as well. Because the mindfulness I'm teaching is not meant only for meditation. It's meant for our whole life. And in fact, the line between meditation and daily life is an arbitrary line, we say. And it's, the idea is to learn how to bring the benefits and the use of attention that we learn in meditation into our rest of our life to improve and facilitate the rest of our life. So so one last chance for a question. Yes, at all. Yes.
So my question is, when I meditate, I realize how much my mind is wandering and racing, and kind of consequently that sort of make me feel quite anxious sometimes, the anticipation of that when I just start meditating.
Anticipating your mind's going to wander a lot.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And then,
So what does that teach you about yourself?
It makes me anxious.
Meditation makes you anxious?
Right.
Good.
Yeah, I notice my heart is racing a little bit because I'm it's going to go again.
Yeah. So a few things to say. One is that one of the first insights in this insight meditation practice that beginning meditators have is that their mind is out of control. The classic description is the mind is a whirlpool. And so many people get discouraged at this point because they think they're supposed to have a calm mind. But to see that your mind is out of control or it's very agitated, and to know it's agitated is better than to have an agitated mind and not know it. So we consider this progress, to see this, what you've seen. So I think you can relax about it. So then part of the mindfulness is to look more carefully at what's going on for yourself. That's why I ask, what does this teach you about yourself? So it might, I don't know you, so I don't know, but it could be that I can imagine someone who has an expectation of what meditation is, successful meditation is supposed to be like, and they're not living up to that expectation, and so they're afraid of failure, and they failed before in their definition of it. And so the idea, oh, I'm going to do this thing again, that I'll fail again. And that makes you anxious. And so that teaches you that maybe you have a person like you might have anxiety around success and failure. And if a person understands that really clearly, then perhaps they can change their perspective about it. And this week, I'm teaching a retreat right now, and there was someone who was supposed to do some technical thing for the retreat. And just a little, very small thing. He was supposed to play a video for the retreat. And he had everything set up, and the computer didn't work. You know, there were like 40, 50 people there waiting, you know, and nothing happened. And so afterwards, I went up to him and said, you know, that was great. There was no problem at all. You know, we didn't have to see the video. It was just, you know, it was great what happened. It's just, you know, it was just opportunity for everyone to sit there. And today he came and told me that that was the first time, he's a man, he's in his 60s. He said that was the first time in his life that someone said it was okay to fail. That's quite something to get to be that age. And, you know, this whole idea of success and failure. So is there a different way of framing it? Maybe it's okay to fail. Maybe we'll learn more about ourselves in failing than we are successful. In fact, there are some people who seem to have a natural ability to get concentrated when they meditate. They sit down, boom, they're still. They can maybe even get blissed out. You know, all these wonderful things happen. And there are other people for whom it takes years and years to get a little bit concentrated and settled. And generally, it's the people who take a long time who get the most insight and the most personal change and transformation. The people who have an easy time at it don't really have to meet themselves, deal with themselves, understand themselves, and their kind of neurosis or their attachments and their clinging tends to continue. So I would welcome what happened and try to relax a little bit around it and be curious. What's this about for you? And what does this teach you about yourself? And is there another way of being with all this? And just be reassured that it's okay what's happening, and you'll find your way. How does that sound? So, okay. So I want to offer you a little wisdom story that kind of will hopefully be in the background of the meditation practice today and maybe in general in your life. And that's a story in the time of the Buddha. And the Buddha was sitting around with a group of people teaching. And he asked them a question. He said, if an archer comes along and takes a bow and arrow and hits another person with the arrow, will the person who gets hit, will it be painful for that person? And so the people listening to the Buddha said, yes, that's painful. And then he said, well, if there's a second arrow that gets shot, will it be even more painful to be hit by a second arrow? And the people say, oh yes, getting two arrows is worse than one. And then the Buddha said, basically he said, the first arrow is what life gives you, what happens in life. The second arrow is the one you shoot yourself. You shoot yourself with. And so if I'm walking down the street here, in front of IMC, and I trip on the sidewalk. Maybe I even fall and skim, you know, hurt my knee. That's the first arrow. The second arrow is, I'm a mindfulness teacher in front of all these people coming from beginning mindfulness class. And now they're going to think I'm mindless. And I'm just, you know, this is terrible. And now I'm afraid. And now I'm, I'm a bad walker. And then I said, you know, how did I get around? You know, I failed at walking in front of all these people. And I'm a bad person. So there's, you know, arrow after arrow I'm shooting at myself. As opposed to walking down the street, tripping, picking myself up, dusting myself off, and going on, I added all these other things on top. And what happens to many people is they don't stop at the second arrow, but there's a third arrow and fourth arrow and fifth arrow. So I could be walking down the street, I could be sitting here meditating, here at IMC. I've come to take an introductory class in mindfulness meditation. And the instructor says, sit and pay attention to your breathing. So I do, and I get maybe a quarter breath that I can pay attention to before my mind wanders off. I try again, and I get an eighth of a breath, and then mind wanders off for 10 minutes. And then I notice I've been wandering off. And then I decide, well, I guess my mind is pretty busy today, and I can't stay with the breath much. It's pretty straightforward. It's kind of uncomfortable. I overate. It's kind of uncomfortable to sit here. Then I say, boy, I really blew it. I ate too much before I came to meditate here. And I have too much, I'm just kind of this, can't figure out how to do my life. I have this roommate who's always complaining about me not doing the dishes. But my roommate, you know, is always critical of me. And anyway, I choose the wrong roommates to live with. And I'm a poor judge of character. And the reason I'm a poor judge of character is because of the way I was brought up. And those parents of mine, they really screwed me up. And I really need to deal with this thing. And but I should do therapy. But I can't afford therapy. And I can't afford therapy, and so here I am again, failing at this, and I'm just no good, and my life is hopeless, and it's the end coming. But I've heard that meditation is offered, they teach meditation for free. Maybe I should try it. And then you, well, oh, but this is where I am. So, you know, we take these, you know, big detours. The mind takes us away as we shoot arrow after arrow, is what I was trying to show. You know, we react, we keep reacting. We have these, you know, and so the idea in meditation is to learn to stop shooting arrows. And it might be that you've managed to reach the 115th generation of arrows. It's really meaningful to stop there and not add 116th. However, if you get to 150, notice you've done 150 arrows yourself. And then you say, boy, am I lousy, shooting all these arrows at myself. You've done 116. And so it is, just at some point, where you can, stop where you can. It doesn't matter what generation it is, stop where you can. And then over time, you can slowly use the mindfulness to notice what's going on, to learn to stop earlier and earlier. And at some point, you'll come to a place where there's a first arrow of life, your back goes out, you get a toothache, you know, you have a flat tire in your car or something. All kinds of things happen that are uncomfortable and difficult. Someone we know gets sick, someone we know dies. It's painful. It's the first arrow. Life comes with the first arrows. It's no way around it. But we can do something about the second arrow. And a day will come where you'll just be present for what's there and you won't add any more arrows. It's just... just this. I just tripped on the sidewalk. Just that. My mind wandering away. Just that. I overate. Just that. I'll try not to overeat next time. So keep it really simple. And so what we're going to do today is to explore mindfulness of emotions. And emotions are a fascinating topic. And often, some emotions are clearly come with an attitude, with motivation. We want something. And sometimes they're called afflictive emotions or reactive emotions, where we're reacting to something. And often enough, the reactive emotions are painful. There's also the responsive emotions, which are not on automatic pilot. We respond in some nice way to what's going on, but it's a response that we have some presence of mind, some freedom within. Reactive emotions, there's very little freedom. We react, and we're kind of acting spontaneously. So emotions are a very important part of human life, and we'll explore it. But some people, as we get familiar with our emotional landscape, will notice that they send second arrows, third arrows, to what emotionally they see inside. It's a difficult emotion, and it's not just letting it be difficult, but it's difficult and I'm somehow at fault that I have this difficult emotion. We add this second layer on top. And what's really great about this meditation practice, this mindfulness, is not laying any extra layers on top of your experience. Letting it be really simple. Just letting it be as simple as you possibly can be. And some people, when they get the hang of it, find that it feels really liberating. It feels such a relief. You mean I'm allowed not to judge myself? I'm allowed not to get reactive? I'm allowed not to judge other people? I'm allowed not to get all worked up? To just let something be that simple? So in the meditation, at least, yes, you're allowed to keep it really simple, just as it is, just as it is. So as we go through the day today with the meditation and things, you might keep a little eye out for if you have second arrows that come along that add a layer of interpretation or reaction on top of what's going on. So let's do a meditation. So take a comfortable, alert posture. And sit up straight. A little bit straighter than normal, just so your spine gives you a little bit of a wakefulness. And then gently close your eyes. And then before we do anything else, check in with yourself and see how you're feeling. What's your mood? What's your emotional state? What's your attitude? How are you right now? And can you be simple with how you are, with what you're feeling? Or are there ideas, judgments, concerns, interpretations, expectations, worries about it, that are layers on top of it? And if so, can you tease apart some of the layers so your attention stays with a primary layer, the simplicity of how you are right now, as if you're allowed to be this way? Sometimes it's good in the beginning of meditation to check in like this, because the mood or the emotional state that you're in can sometimes cast an influence on top of your meditation. But if you can recognize what your mood is, sometimes maybe it doesn't have to be, the mood doesn't have to influence your meditation as much. Keep it simple. So, to begin, you can take some long, slow, deep breaths. Letting your chest fill, your belly expand, your shoulders lift. And as you exhale, maybe a long exhale, relaxing. breathing in and then exhaling and softening the shoulders. Breathing in and softening around the face. And then letting your breath return to normal. And as you breathe normally, check in some more with your body, the physical sensations of your body. Letting those sensations be simple, without second arrows, without commentary. Just checking in. And then within the body, as part of the body, become aware of how your body experiences breathing. And notice how the inhalation is experienced differently than the exhalation. Notice if you're breathing relatively fast or relatively slow. Either way is fine. Just notice how it is for you. And notice if you're giving more attention to your thinking than you are your breathing. And if you are, can you shift the balance so there's more attention to your breathing and the thinking can recede into the background? And then as you breathe in, see if you can keep your attention present for the full experience of breathing in, from the beginning to the end, and similar to how you would pet a cat, and keep your hand there fully for the full length of the cat. And as you exhale, stay there for the full length of the exhale, like you're petting the cat. Staying with the breath, with the breathing. If your mind wanders off in thought and you notice it, see if you can let go of your thinking or let it recede in the background. And then begin again with your breathing. And now we're going to shift away from focusing on breathing and spend a little bit of time with how you're feeling. So as you're sitting here now, what is your emotional state or your mood or attitude? Are you happy or sad? Confident or doubtful? Are you curious and interested, or are you bored? Are you content and calm, or are you non-contented, maybe agitated? It could be that your mood or emotional state is very subtle. And if you identify something that could fit the category of a mood or emotional state, an attitude, recognize it clearly. And with a quiet mind, so you're not thinking so much about it, allow it to be there. Without adding second arrows or interpretations. Quietly allow it to just be there as if it has permission to be there for you. It's completely okay for these minutes. And then get interested in how the mood or the emotional state is experienced in your body. What parts of your body seem energized or activated by this emotional state or mood? Is there some place in your body where it lives? And if there is, take a few moments here to just feel the experience in your body, the bodily aspect of this emotion. Again, as if it has permission to be there. And you're just going to be mindful of how it's held in the body. And one of the layers we put on top of our emotions is identifying with them, taking them as my emotion, or that says something about me. If you sit quietly and allow it to be there, feel it in your body, and see if you can not identify with it. It's just a phenomena that's there. You're allowed to be this way. You make space for it. If your mood or emotional state shifts, changes as you're watching it, what takes its place? And finally, if you have a reaction or resistance or judgments towards your emotional state, do you give more attention to the reaction or more attention to the emotional state itself? See if you can give more attention to the basic, raw emotional state, being simple, just this, as if there's no problem, just what it is. And then for the last minute or so of this meditation, coming back to your breathing. Breathe mindfully. Mindfully breathe in, mindfully breathe out. And then to end this sitting, you can take some long, slow breaths. Again, feel your body. Feel your body against the chair or the cushion. And then when you're ready, you can open your eyes. So, an analogy for what breathing can do for us, how it's helpful in our lives, is that of the keel of a sailboat. And the keel has ballast, has weight in it. And both the depth of the keel and the weight of it keeps the sailboat from tipping over. So no matter what the wind might blow it this way and that way, but it doesn't tip over, it doesn't, because of that keel. If we stay with our breathing through our lives and stay connected to the breath and the breath in our body, it kind of works as a stabilizing force in our life. It kind of grounds us, it gives kind of a ballast for what's going on. And it's much easier to go through the winds of life and the winds of your own mind if you have this, you know, connected to a ballast, to a keel. So the breathing in the torso, the breathing in the belly, feeling the movements, being connected here. So if you kind of keep that going, keep a kind of continuity of attention to breathing, it's harder to get lost in your thoughts or get lost in the reactivity. And so some people find it's phenomenally helpful to go through life, checking in with your breath, being with your breath, meditation, being with your breath, because it's protection from getting lost in the reactive mind. So we put a lot of emphasis on mindfulness of breathing as we do this. However, the practice of mindfulness is about learning to be mindful in all aspects of our life, not just breathing. And so if there is something that's more compelling than breathing, then we can let go of our attention to the breath and take up this other thing to pay attention, to be mindful there. So we talked last week, we talked about body sensations. If body sensations become strong and there's a tug of war between you trying to stay with the breath and the strong body sensations wanting your attention, there's no need for that tug of war. Just let go of focusing on the breath and let your mindfulness focus on this strong sensation. It's a present moment experience, and you're cultivating present moment awareness on a present moment experience. If emotions become compelling, then at that time, we can also let go of the breathing and we do mindfulness of emotions. If the emotions are subtle, your mood is subtle and background and you can stay with the breath, there's no need to be concerned with your emotional state. But when it gets loud, and so it pulls your attention, then you can just turn around and look at your emotions right in the face. Just see it for what it is. Emotions are a very important part of human life, and they should be respected and given time. And one of the wonderful things about something like meditation is that it's one of the few places in life, for many people, where it's completely okay to have any emotion that you're having. Because you're safe, right? You're sitting there quietly. You're not going to move, supposedly. So you could be enraged and full of fury at someone, murderous rage. And meditation, you know, in daily life, like with your boss, you better not do that at work. Maybe it's not so safe. But you can have murderous rage towards your boss in meditation because you're not going to do anything. And so you can allow that energy and that emotion to be there in its simple, full way. And begin sorting out the second arrows, the interpretations, the reactions, and slowly begin to see what's going on. And perhaps let the energy disperse itself rather than keep stirring it up. You can have a wonderful angelic love in meditation. And in daily life, it might not be right. You know, again, back at work, and walk around in a cloud, angelic love, and they want the job done. And so it's not maybe the place to kind of ooze with love. But in meditation, you can ooze all you want. You can just be there, just allow it to be there. And so one of the great functions, very healing functions of meditation like this, is that we give freedom to our inner life. It's a safe place to let it free. We don't have to repress emotions. We don't have to validate emotions. We don't have to celebrate certain emotions. We can just be really simple and given the freedom to be what they are. And many people don't have that opportunity in parts of their lives. They get the message of certain emotions are not acceptable. We have to keep them to ourselves. We don't want to admit them even to ourselves sometimes. And that creates a bottleneck, that of tension and pressure and unconscious material within us, which is not very healthy. And so to kind of wake up in Buddhism is to wake up in such a way that the full spectrum of who we are as human being has a place. So our full range of emotional life has a place. And as we learn to be with it in meditation, without reactivity, without buying into it, without being pushed around by our emotions, without necessarily believing everything that we think about them, we just sit there quietly. We begin to find how to be free from them, or free with them. And so they can be there, but we're not buying them, we're not, you know, engaged in them, we're not lost in them, we're not, you know, they're just there in a simple way. And one of the ways we talk about this in Buddhism is we're not identifying with them, which means we don't define ourselves by them. So there might be anger, but we don't say, I'm angry, there's just anger that's there. We might have love or happiness, we don't say it's my happiness, we say there's just happiness there. Because my is an added layer on, it turns out to be an added layer on top of the basic simplicity of the situation. And this relief that mindfulness can provide of just allowing things to be simple as they are comes from just allowing each emotion to be as it is itself. Now, it's sometimes hard to do, and especially for reactive or afflictive emotions. And what we do is we can get attached to them, we can resist them, we can lock on to them, we can have all kinds of complicated relationships. So that, and this is one of the things we start seeing, how we complicate it more than it needs to be. So for example, resentment is frozen anger, is anger which we're holding on to. And so that holding on to is different than just letting the anger be there. And it's a lot healthier just to let the anger be there in a very simple way than it is to be locked into the resentment. The Charlie Brown, he knew all about good grief. And if that's the language, and bad grief is grief where we're locked into the grief. But to allow the grief to flow through us without resistance is good grief. Just let it be there. And who knows how long it has to come. So we're giving freedom to our inner life. So in order to do this, and to practice mindfulness, this freedom and mindfulness of our emotional life, whether it's difficult or pleasant or enjoyable emotions, we have an acronym, a teaching, that offers kind of four perspectives on how to be mindful of emotions. And it is called the RAIN acronym. RAIN. And the RAIN, the R, is really the beginning, is to recognize that you're having an emotion. And for some people, that's really big. It can take a while to recognize you have something going on. And so we want to get good and to be able to recognize what's happening earlier and earlier. So we can say, I'm afraid. I didn't realize how afraid I was. I'm happy. It's nice. It's fine. How long have I been happy? I've been missing out on all this happiness. I mean, I think I've been feeling happy for half an hour, but I haven't been paying attention. So to recognize what's there. And so that's why this present moment attention, coming back to the present moment, what's here? What's here? What's here? We have a chance to recognize what we're feeling. If we recognize what we're feeling, then we can be wiser about what we're feeling. If we recognize that we're grumpy, then maybe we can be more careful about how we go around the world being grumpy. Maybe we don't have to speak grumpy ways because we know we take ownership and responsibility for how we feel. So the first thing is to recognize what's going on. The second is to allow it to be there. It's so, you know, especially learning to do this in meditation is very helpful for the reason that's safe in meditation to allow things to be there. So allow it to be there. And it takes a while to learn how to do that. It's not something you can sit down and just do immediately. It's just, okay, I'm going to allow it to be there. But it takes a while. You know, that's the direction we're going, to come to a time and place where we can just be very simple and let whatever the emotion is there, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, just to be there in a relaxed, open way. It's a powerful thing to learn to do. Your life will go a lot easier if you learn the art of just letting an emotion just be there. As it is. So allowing it to be there. The third, the I part, is investigation or interest. Look more carefully at it. But many people, when they hear the word investigation, consider that to be analysis, kind of thinking about it and trying to understand it in some kind of conceptual way. Mindfulness, investigation in mindfulness practice is more like silent investigation. It's more like, I don't know, if you're in the dark and you want to feel the texture of the wall, you don't know what it is, so you put your hand and you feel it silently. You know, you don't, and then you feel the texture. You're investigating it, but you're not thinking about the texture, you're just feeling it for what it is. So with emotions, the idea is to investigate it in that kind of silent way in which we feel it in our body. Every emotion has a corollary expression or manifestation in the body. Sometimes it's quite subtle. Sometimes it's quite strong. We have expression, you know, like, you know, a pit in my stomach because I'm afraid. Or, you know, hot in the face from being angry. Or, you know, shoulders tense because we're afraid again. Or feeling really soft and relaxed because we're happy. Or, you know, we've fallen in love and, you know, everything is so soft and so nice, right? And you can feel that softness perhaps somewhere, or the warmth in the heart we might feel. So emotions will have some expression in their body. And so the investigation is to drop into the body and feel it there. And that does a number of important things in relationship to emotions. The bodily expression of an emotion is not a story. It's just a thing of the moment. Whereas when emotions are strong, there's a very strong tendency for us to go into our head and have stories about it. This means that, like for me, I remember when I was, I had a summer when I was 21, maybe 20 or 21. And I had a not very nice summer. Very nice. I spent most of it in nature, outdoors. And I was kind of ecstatic by the end of the summer. And I concluded that I would never be depressed again. That fall, I was more depressed than I'd ever been in my life. So I made these kind of, and then, you know, I thought I'm going to be depressed forever. To keep it really simple, just the ecstasy. Don't make any conclusions. Just depression, no conclusions. The conclusions we make often complicate it, and often become self-reinforcing. That makes things last longer than they have to be. So we want to kind of, so there's a story we make. So this means it's going to last forever. This means that, you know, I'm unacceptable in the eyes of other people because I have this kind of emotional response. Or this means that, or this is because, if we start thinking about the story, this is because of my boss at work and she did this and he did that and I should have said that. And as we tell ourselves a story, we get all worked up. I'll tell you a story. I won't get worked up too much. But many years ago, I was teaching a retreat at a Catholic, we'd rented a Catholic kind of monastery, actually a convent. And so it had this wonderful kind of, it was beautiful kind of monastic grounds. And take my word, it was beautiful, peaceful, nice. And we had this magical meditation session one morning. It was November, the light was coming in really beautifully, it was very quiet and still, and the fall. And like there was a room of about 50 people meditating, and it seemed like everyone got so peaceful and calm. It was like so pristine, like looking at a early morning, maybe alpine lake, so everything's still and quiet. And anyway, it was really nice. So after that meditation session, I was going to meet with a student. I have these regular meetings with people on retreat. And I sat in this nice little monastic cell room that I love. I'm monastically inclined, so sitting in the cell room was really nice for me. Sat in a chair, and this woman came in to be with me, sit opposite me, and talk about her practice. And this is a woman I'd known for some time who was deeply, deeply troubled. And a lot of challenges in her life, emotional challenges, interpersonal challenges, kind of often kind of in a knot around all her challenges and emotional life and the stories of her life and who did what to who and things like that. So I've been working and having a student-teacher relationship with her for a while, and so I knew her background. And she came in to see me after this magical session, meditation session. I was in this deep, peaceful place. She was in a deep, peaceful place. I'd never seen her so peaceful and so calm and so just there in a simple way. It felt so nice. It didn't feel like we should talk even. Just be there in a simple, peaceful way. Nothing was needed. And then we started talking a little bit. Maybe I said, "How are you?" or something. And she said, "Oh, I'm fine. Things are really good, peaceful and nice. But yesterday, I was miserable." And she started telling me about yesterday. And as she was telling me about what happened yesterday, she became miserable. She's all knotted up into terror. And I thought, why did she have to bring yesterday into the picture? Today is today. Yesterday is yesterday. It's gone. But she was so identified and so attached and consumed by the story of yesterday that she kind of inhabited all the misery of yesterday in her reactions and responses. So we have these stories we tell ourselves, and the stories fuel our emotional life many times. The body is not a story. So if you can drop, if you feel an emotion, and then drop into your body and feel it in your body, and then just keep the attention there, like the ballast, you know, just stay there in the body, feel it there, be present for it there. That protects you from drifting off too easily into the stories, which is a great thing, because it's kind of like, maybe I used this analogy before, but you know the little jack-in-the-box toy? You know, there's this little clown inside on a spring. And if you take off the lid, the jack-in-the-box jumps up. And what happens there is that the energy or the tension of the spring gets released. And the spring is quite happy to finally be free of its tension. It's been down there for a long time, being tense. Finally. Because it's begun in space. So the same thing for our inner life. For our inner life, if it has space, the tension begins to release itself. And one of the ways to give space to our emotions, one is to allow it to be there, but the other way is to feel it in our body. There's something about present moment awareness of how an emotion is occurring in the body. And we're just there with it and feel it. It's kind of like making space for it. And then whatever tension or holding or whatever process is there in the emotion has a chance to release and unfold. Is this making some sense on this? So rain, recognize, allow, investigate, and the last one is non-identification. It's kind of like a Buddhist thing, to not identify. But it means to don't define yourself by the emotion. Like, this means that I, you know, will always be miserable. This means I'll always be happy. This means that I'm a good person, I'm a bad person. This means that my parents should have raised me better. You know, just, you know, don't identify with it. Just let it just be very simple. And this is one of the hardest things to learn to do because of the very strong tendency we have to take everything personally. And to learn not to take things too personally brings a lot of freedom. And the kind of freedom, it's not a freedom that denies ourselves, but actually enhances ourselves, because the inner life has more freedom when it's not put in a box of taking it personally. So recognize, allow, investigate, and non-identification. So that's been a lot I've said here. I apologize for saying so much. Questions, requests for clarity, protests? If no one asks a question, then I'll think that I stumped you all.
Come on, I came all the way over here to get it so I could bring it to you.
Maybe you can pass the one on the stage down to him so he's ready. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of times when a feeling comes up, it starts with like a thought or an image in my meditation. So I'm thinking about something or I picture something, like maybe a boss or some work I had to do. But you're saying like once the feeling comes out because of that, don't go back to the thought. Just kind of like drop into your body.
Well, if you want to meditate, yes, don't go back to the thought.
Okay.
I mean, daily life, sometimes it's nice to go into your thoughts and do, you know, explore it and be with it. But in meditation, you want to become learn to be free of that and not be so entangled in it. So it's a process of separating yourself from the entanglement with thoughts. And so, because otherwise you just keep fueling this and you can't settle down.
So maybe my follow-up is like, what can you expect if you like keep doing that? Is eventually those thoughts don't stimulate stronger emotions or?
A number of things can happen. One is that you get wise about thinking. And we'll talk about thoughts next week. Many people have never really examined the phenomena of thinking. And so they give a lot of authority to their thoughts, unnecessarily so. And to learn to put thoughts in the right place is very freeing. It's very, very helpful and very wise thing to do. So be able to kind of let go of thoughts, come back to the body, begins to teach us to be wiser and wiser about thoughts, to see them with greater clarity. We can't see them clearly for what they are if we're in the thinking. Make sense? Okay. Yes.
The question I had was about...
Is it on? Green light?
The question I had was, what happens when an emotion arises in the course of daily life? Is my sense is that do we slow down? Do we sit and go through that same process? It seems like that would be logical, but we don't always have that luxury.
Yeah, yeah. So it can be nice to do that in daily life. If something's really strong and powerful, someone actually just told me today that she got a very difficult phone call. But because she learned to do this practice, normally she would have stayed, it was very difficult and she froze. And normally she would have stayed frozen, traumatized by what information she got for 2 or 3 days. But because she knew this practice and she took this RAIN acronym and went through it step by step, that it lasted for about an hour as she kind of worked the process. And so then when she went home to her family, she was able to be present for her family in a loving way. And her kids actually were much more, she said, my kids came over and cuddled with me. They don't usually do that. So I think for her, because it was so dramatic what happened to her, she really took the time out to go through it. And maybe she didn't have the luxury not to. But sometimes we can't stop and do all that. But what happens is that you can get faster and faster at this. As you get familiar with the territory and learn how to do it. And it becomes second nature. And after a while, it can happen in real time. That you have an emotion arises, and you have no inclination to interfere with it. You just allow it to be there, but you also have no inclination to identify with it and act on it. So you can be angry with your boss, but you feel that anger arise. It's free within you, inside of you. It's completely free. It comes. It bubbles up, but there's no obvious connection to your actions and your words because. It's very simple. You're just allowing it to be there, and you're present. You know it's there, so you recognize it. You allow it. You can feel it in your body, and the non-identification can all kind of happen all simultaneously, and you stay, for all practical purposes, you stay calm in the situation. Does that make sense?
So till last week, I think I was getting everything. I'm totally confused today because I have like these conflicting questions in my mind. So at one point you said, let the emotions just be there. So let me just take an example. I got a phone call and two emotions arise, which happened actually while I was driving here. I got a phone call and now I'm thinking about it. It's both sympathy but also anger. So I come here and I'm trying to analyze my emotions as we go through the meditation practice. And so I say it's there, but it has to be followed with some action, right? Do I do something? How do I let go? Meaning, I think when anger has to be let go, because if I say anger is there, for me, one of them has to rise and one of them has to fall, right? So either I'm going to take my next action based on my anger, or I let my anger go and take the other action based on my sympathy. So I'm kind of confused about the whole concept of being with your emotions and recognizing it, but then what next happens?
So I think what you, in order to understand what I'm doing, then we're going to have to make a distinction between the time and place to just be with your experience without any action, and a separate time when we have to decide how to act. And so, and as we learn to be with our experience better and better, you're in a better position to know how to act. If you're agitated or restless or caught up in the emotion, many people make mistakes, right? Because they're acting out of the emotion rather than out of wisdom. So the first thing to learn, that's why the meditation is so good, meditation is not the place to figure out what to do. It's how to figure out how to be with it, how to be. And then, so in your situation, you have two emotions. What we do in mindfulness meditation is we bring our attention to what's most compelling. So if one of them is more compelling than the other, that's what you pay attention to. If they're equally compelling, just choose one. And so if anger is the most compelling one, you have a belief that you have to somehow dissipate the anger, resolve the anger, fix the anger, act or something. That's a layer on top. For this purpose here, of just being, that's a layer on top. And so you can put that aside for now. And don't try to fix the anger, but trust the inner process as it moves through you to see what happens as you learn about it. A very important thing that I learned, I'd been a monk, Buddhist monk, and done a lot of practice for many years. And I had learned how to let go really well. I could let go of almost anything. And then someone told me that of a new practice around anger. And that was, don't let it go right away, but let it hover. And so I had to train myself to let my anger stay there and hover so I could study it and understand it and be with it. And I learned a lot about myself by spending time with my anger, not fixing it, but just being with it. So there's a time and place for it. What you're going to do, you need a lot of wisdom, you need street smarts, you have to understand the circumstances, what you need to do. I can't tell you what to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. And actually it answered my other question, which was, so if you are coming to a state where you're basically seeing that it's just an emotion and getting to the base of emotion, when you come out of it, the whole meditation, and you keep practicing this for a while, do you become emotionless? Because you can't, because my kids are there, and right now, I have my daughter, and she gets hurt, and I feel really bad about her, and I'm all, over her and helping her. But if I'm thinking, it's just a hurt, it'll get better, right? Uh-huh. Will I be in a better state to calm her, or I don't know, I'm just... that's what I was saying. I was so confused. Yeah. But I think your answer kind of answered my question also.
I'll tell you another little story. After I spent 3 years living in a Zen monastery, a Zen monk, strong Zen practice, getting up early in the morning, meditating, doing the whole thing for 3 years. And then I left the monastery, and the movie Gandhi had just come out, and I went to see the movie. And I cried during the movie. And I never had cried in movies before. So I was leaving the movie theater. I said to myself, 3 years of Zen practice, and I failed. And the next moment I thought, no, Gil, you succeeded. My emotional sensitivity, empathy, the movement of the were flowed much more freely. So I became richer, and my emotional life has become richer and more meaningful through all this. I have less reactive emotions. You know, I have more responsive emotions. So like with your daughter, is your emotions reactive or responsive? So if she's having a hard time and you're acting from your fear and you think, oh no, you see her whole future up ahead. You know, oh no, she'll never get to a good college now. And, you know, and then she'll never get a good job and she'll never, you know, like I better, you know, she's so upset about her homework and oh no, I better, you know, get her a school coach and help her and tell her it's okay and give her more cookies and she'll feel better. And, you know, you're probably doing your daughter a disservice, right? But you could feel compassion and empathy with no fear. And she might thrive on feeling that you're there with her and you're not fixing her, but she feels your warmth. Make sense?
Yes.
Somehow?
Thank you.
So the emotional life gets richer and more meaningful. Another question here? Can you pass it back?
Thank you. For me, it's hard to differentiate between emotion and thought.
Yes.
They're so married together that, I mean, the only emotion that I've ever really felt with that wasn't connected to a thought would be like if someone almost hit me in a car or something like that.
Right.
So when I'm trying to be with the emotion, I find that I'm being with my thought and then I'm thinking. So I don't know if you have any ideas about that.
Yeah. Yes. Emotions are not a single thing. They're a composite made of different elements, and one of them is thoughts. Sometimes there are motivations that are involved, something we want. But because they're so closely intertwined, if we stay in the loops of thinking, the story-making mind, it can continue to fuel the thoughts. And so some people can actually work themselves into a lather because they're telling them a story. I mean, I've sometimes sat and meditated, you know, I'm quiet and peaceful, minding my own business, and just being calm. And then there's some sound outside, I hear someone speaking, and it sounds like my high school girlfriend. And the anger comes up, and I start thinking about what happened, what she did to me in high school, and the stories, and how could she have said that and done that, and I was just minding my own business, being calm, and you know, and that story kind of, you know, I didn't have to get involved in those thoughts. So as the mindfulness gets stronger, we see the place of choice. We see, oh, the girlfriend thoughts come up. I don't need to go there. There's no need to bring that up. And then those emotions don't get churned up. Does that make sense? So we start getting wise and understand how all this works much better. But yeah, they are connected. But if you can help tease those apart and see them as separate, then you're less likely to be entangled in them. And one of the ways to do that is to feel the physical, bodily side of the emotion. And that's always in the present moment. The story might not be about the present. And so when we did that exercise before, could you locate your emotions, your mood, and your body?
Yes, I could. It's just that it's hard for me to disconnect them because they're kind of like one thing. I mean, they're like one...
Yeah. With time, you'll be able to separate them out. It takes a while. This is just a beginning class. I'm just giving you the tools and the map. And then as you do this slowly, you'll start understanding how it works. And you'll be able to see them apart. Next week, we'll talk about thinking. And so for now, I would encourage you, just if this coming week, just keep coming back to your body. So if you have an emotion, come back to the bodily side of it. And just be with it that way, in a simple way. And next week, we'll talk about emotions. Okay? Other questions, comments? So there's a wonderful thing about someone there? Okay.
Could you talk more about the difference between responsive and reactive emotions?
Uh-huh. Yeah. I think of reactive emotions as emotions that impel us to act or to have a reaction. So anger, for example, you want to lash out suddenly. You might not lash out, but you're reacting against something. Compassion is a response because you're not necessarily... you're not reacting, but you're kind of glowing. It's kind of, it rises in response with... we're not triggered by it. We're not challenged by it. We're not... there's a kind of a different trigger inside, or a different thing that gets stimulated inside when we see someone suffering and we get angry versus we see someone suffering and we have compassion. And so the reactive emotions, sometimes they're called afflictive emotions, because they're the emotions that hurt to have. The responsive emotions don't hurt, are not painful. So I don't know if that's an adequate answer. Is that adequate?
I feel like it's something to think about.
Good, thank you, because I didn't feel it was very adequate, so. So there's a, I think it's very nice that the English word emotion comes from Latin, and the E part in Latin means out, and motion means motion. All emotions are processes, and they want to work themselves out if we get out of the way. And when we identify with the emotions, we think we have to solve it. We have to act on it. We have to do something with it. And sometimes we do, for sure. But what a lot of people haven't learned is how to relax and let go of our involvement with them and allow a natural inner wisdom to operate that allow the inner process of the emotion to unfold by itself. People who have strong grief, like someone close to them has died, sometimes we'll slowly learn this, that they're better off just getting out of the way and letting the emotion, the grief, move through than to resist it or to fight it or to judge it. The grief has its own lifetime, its own wisdom, its own way of moving through us. And the best thing we can do is not add suffering on top of it by judging ourselves that, oh, we should be over now. You know, we've been grieving for 6 months. And my friends tell me I should be over it. You know, I'm still grieving. And then we feel bad about ourselves. But there's no need to, we have to trust the inner process. And people who go through grief well are the ones who tend to just let it kind of move through freely. A friend of mine who lost three significant people in her life in 1 year, her father, her brother, and her maybe close friend. And so so she was grieving deeply. But she was a meditator, so she went on a retreat. I think she did a 10-day retreat. And she said there was a big difference between having the grief in daily life and having it on the retreat, where the retreat is a place where there's a lot of careful mindfulness. And in daily life, the grief would come in waves, and she learned to just ride the waves. But the waves would last for an hour or two or a period of time. On the retreat, the waves were more intense, but they only last for a minute or two. And the reason for that was on the retreat, she could give herself time to really make space for the grief and allow for it without being distracted from it or the complications of daily life, resisting it a little bit because she's having a conversation with, you know, someone. But just really kind of let it be there. Emotions, all emotions want to move. And one of the phenomenal things to discover that as we become more and more mindful of them, we can trust the inner life. We can really trust ourselves, no matter how difficult the emotion is within. If we can be mindful, have this non-reactive, present moment awareness that holds it, that allows it to be there, the inner landscape becomes trustable. And to really be able to trust what's in here is a great gift. Make sense? Doesn't make sense. Oh, sorry.
Are you saying that you can trust your, like, the way you're responding, like, you let that, you just, you're like, yes, this is, my response is natural, my response, and just be with that response versus, like...
Well, response is maybe a little bit... So let's start first by the reference point of sitting in meditation, right? If you, because here you're not going to hit anyone or do something, right? So in this situation here, if you can practice this rain, recognize what's there, allow what's there, investigate it, don't identify with it. It's kind of like getting out of the way, letting it move through you. Then you'll learn that it's trustable, your inner life is trustable, that something inside will... It'll be painful, you'll see all kinds of things, but it's a process that unfolds and moves towards health. As we learn to do it in meditation, then we can slowly learn to do it in daily life, where we there also can let things happen and trust the inner landscape. But that doesn't mean that we trust every response we have. Like, my response is to tell you that you are whatever. And, you know, I'm told to trust whatever my response is. I mean, that's silly, right? So you don't necessarily say everything you want to say, but you trust that if you have this, you can trust how things unfold within you, and then hopefully you have a lot of wisdom in what you say. And you can have more wisdom if you've learned not to identify or be caught by the emotions. Make sense? So I want to repeat that I think it's very generous, and I would say compassionate for ourselves, to give us an occasion in our life where any emotion we have has permission to be there. And that meditation is one of those places. And probably there's many situations in life where it's not okay, you know, because it's complicated, whatever. And as we learn to give ourselves that permission, then we can investigate to understand what's going on. One of the things to investigate is the connection between the stories and thoughts and how they fuel and keep the emotions going. And if we can somehow separate those out and just stay in the present moment, not be so involved in the stories, then that's when the inner trustable landscape begins to show itself. As long as we're thinking about things and telling stories about our things, and having discursive conversations about what, you know, our situation in life is, then it very easily becomes not so trustable. It's possible. I mean, thinking is important and sometimes very useful. But I think that most people overthink. But the cost of overthinking is that they are not in touch with these deeper inner processes that can operate, the deeper ways in which emotions reveal themselves and show us themselves and show their wisdom to us and move through us. The way that the breathing is a very powerful spiritual process that can show us, reveal wisdom to us and lots of understanding. The way the body is a phenomenal spiritual phenomena, tremendous wisdom and understanding there. So if you overthink and oversolve, we don't allow this deeper dimensions of our being to come up. So the thing to do is not to think for the next week. Because it's next week that we're going to talk about thinking. I know some of you are kind of jumping ahead and already started thinking, but, you know, slow down. It's coming next week. So we have 6 minutes left, and... I suggest that we end with a short 5-minute meditation. Sitting quietly. Gently, kindly with yourself. Kind attention to yourself. And you might begin with a simple check-in. How are you now? What's your mood, emotional state, or attitude? How involved are you with your mood? How invested or identified are you with it? And perhaps you can drop into your body and feel what's going on in your body. And then within your body, become aware of your body breathing. Letting go of your thoughts and letting your breathing be the ballast, the grounding, the centering place that supports you to be present here, now, one breath at a time. And then you can take a couple of deep breaths to end the sitting. So there is this pink handout which talks a little bit, gives a summary of the instructions and gives some exercises you can do at home and some more discussions about emotions if you'd like. And if what I said today seemed complicated, the default for this meditation practice is to be simple. So whenever you think it's getting complicated, make it simpler. And one of the simple ways of doing it is just come back to your breathing. Just start again with your breath. And the other way to keep it simple is to just be mindful of what's obvious. If it's not obvious, then don't worry about it. So if it's getting complicated, go back to simplicity. Yes? So thank you all. There's just a couple of the senior students here today. There's Tanya, who was with the mic, and Richard is here at the soundboard. So if you want to ask them any questions or comments about this, you're welcome to. And I hope that you enjoy your emotional life this week.